I'm very happy to be here. This is a fantastic place. I'm enjoying every moment of it since Sunday until today. And I'm a fluid mechanicist. So this will be, as yesterday was on laminar flow, and today we'll be talking mostly on turbulence. But I'll try to mix here some basic and like everyday meteorology and some things which could be interested for physicists, like whether there is a conformally invariant field theory that could have some relations to our weather. And it's all will be highly speculative, so as most of theoretical physics. But the question is, what drives weather changes? And for physicists, the answer to it evident: whatever moves on this planet is known being driven by energy from what? From sun. Sun is our only source of energy. So now if you any question that what drives you, me, wind, ocean flow, bird, it's always sun, so we can stop here and the talk and go back to our works. So in a sense, now that we get a general answer that sun drives everything, we may now ask about details. How actually the energy of the sun gets into something which changes weather from yesterday to today. Yesterday we had rain, today we have sun. So it will be about winds and how wind gets its energy from sun, which is again pretty simple and basic things. So I'll start even not from hydrodynamics, I'll start from hydrostatics. And the equation of hydrostatics is very simple. It tells you that if fluid does not move, the only thing that it has inside is a pressure field. It's a scalar, which is gradient of which is a force acting normally to any surface. And it's equal to whatever external forces act on it. And then the forces usually which act is a gravity force, which means that it's a gradient of some scalar potential. And then if we just take a curl of this equation, we immediately conclude that the gradient of rho must be perpendicular to the gradient of phi, or that the, to put it simply, the layers of equal density must be coinciding with levels of equal gravity. Namely that here, the close to the surface, these layers must be horizontal. And which immediately tells us that if you look at our planet and the sun, what it does a differential heating. It hits equator, right? And so it's hot, and the pole is cold, and also it has day and night parts, which immediately tells us that there is a horizontal gradient of temperature and related to it horizontal gradient of density. But on the previous slide, we've seen that if we have a horizontal gradient of density, the fluid cannot be in at rest. It must move. So the simple statement is that what drives wind, if it's a horizontal gradient of temperature. Any horizontal gradient of temperature immediately causes the motion of air from one place to another. So now we know what drives wind, but it's not the end of the story, because this heating also makes for a vertical gradient. And the reason for it is that the air is transparent, and mostly heat of sun, the radiation is absorbed by a surface, by soil. And as it absorbs, then this soil is usually the hottest part. And then temperature drops as we go up. Which is a non-trivial statement, by the way. Aristotle believed otherwise, because he believed that as you go higher and higher, you're closer and closer to sun, and so it must be hotter and hotter, by the way. It seems very reasonable, right? And it's amazing that somebody who lived in Greece, where you can just go to any hill and it immediately feel 3 or 4 degrees colder, that still believed that as you go higher, you increase temperature. In reality, you can say that the temperature is a function of vertical coordinate, could be kind of linearly dropping. It actually drops for some until troposphere, and then it started to rise for different reasons. But we'll be interested in the first 10 kilometers of Earth's atmosphere. And here, the temperature profile could very well be preserved as linear. And of course, it causes the pressure profile, because temperature and density both change with the height, and then pressure change with the height. And this factor alpha over here, which is a typical length, it's of order of, it's degrees per length. It's of order of 6.5 degrees per kilometer. That's how much you lose as you go 1 kilometer higher. It's on average 6 degrees Celsius colder. Now we may ask, if we have a hot air down there and colder air up there, it could be unstable with respect to convection, because the hot air would want to go up. So let's see what makes this stability or instability. Just as usual in physics, when you try to imagine whether it's stable or unstable, you make a mental experiment. You take a parcel of air from here, move it there. Of course, it immediately acquires the pressure which is there, but it keeps its temperature from here. And you ask whether it would want to return back or it would continue going up, which is basically this inequality. Or even simpler, you may say, if you move by dz vertically, that's how much you gain by potential energy, and that's how much you lose by internal energy. And so you need to compare one with another. And then you get a condition for stability, which is an upper bound on a vertical temperature gradient, and it's about 10 degrees per kilometer. Which means that if the temperature gradient is higher than 10 degrees per kilometer, then you locally have an instability of convection. And on average, it's 6.5 degrees, which means that somehow somebody designed our atmosphere in such a way that it is on average stable, but it's always on the brink of instability. Namely, that any small change in the albedo of a surface, just you go from a forest to a park, or from a park to a parking lot, and you get from 6 to 11 degrees per kilometer, just that much difference in temperature between these two areas. And anybody who flew balloon or even a small plane knows very well how non-uniform is a convective pattern, particularly all over the big city. Okay, so we get the second source of motion of the air. It's a vertical gradient. So we have horizontal gradient, and they act on a scale of a planet, namely between equator and pole, which is like 6,400 is our radius, like 10,000 kilometers. And we have a vertical gradient of a scale of 10 kilometers, which is the troposphere height. But weather is something which is driven, this is Canada and the western part of the United States. That's a typical vortex that you can see, and that what actually drives the typical changes of the weather. The typical winds over there are like 20, 30 meters per second. And the changes which happened on a scale of days and hours is usually big vortices which have scales like 400 kilometers, 500 kilometers, 1,000 kilometers. And so it's basically now I repose the question which I will be talking about. What drives these big vortices, which has scale of few hundred kilometers? Where they get their energy from? From this 10 kilometers scale convection, or from this 10,000 kilometers planetary scale flows? So that's basically the question, because sun inputs its energy into a big flow on a planetary scale, and also on a flow on a much smaller scale. You would say, what's the problem? It can get it from both ends, right? And here, turbulence theory comes and tells you something. This is another vortex about this. It's like almost 1,000 kilometer vortex. And if you really look at what is the distribution of energy over scales in the atmosphere, this is a spectrum of zonal wind, which is along this direction, and meridional wind along this direction. You see that it's distributed energetically pretty uniformly over the scales. This is a wave number. So this is 10 kilometers. This ni is about 500-600 kilometers, and that's 10,000 kilometers over here scale. So you see that more or less, as you would expect from a very turbulent system, it has a continuous spectra. And of course, this is, by the way, it's an old measurement, well, actually 83. It was a plane flying from Chicago to Honolulu and back. And this plane flew many, many times, and on its way, it measured wind velocity. And then after many, many such measurements, the spectra were computing as an averages. Okay? And so first of all, of course, physicists would see such thing and immediately fit it by a power law. And this power law is five-third, namely that the energy in a given k wave number decays with k is k minus five-third, which some of you may have heard that it's Kolmogorov spectrum, and it's a very actually non-trivial whether it's Kolmogorov spectrum or not. And then another fit was like k minus three, et cetera. So let me reiterate. Sun puts energy here, and sun put energy here. Where energy here appears, it comes from here, just that this big flow getting unstable breaks into smaller vortices. They break into smaller and smaller vortices. It's what we call direct cascade, namely cascade from large scale towards smaller scales. Or this energy at this hundreds of kilometers come from this small convection, namely that we have this three-dimensional convection, and eventually it produces larger and larger plane vortices, which would be having scale much exceeding the thickness of the atmosphere. Okay, so that's basically choice between these two possibilities. And what makes it really non-trivial is that the puzzle is that three-dimensional small-scale motion that we have in this convective turbulence, they want to burn all energy in the direct cascade. Namely, if you excite three-dimensional motion, it would produce smaller and smaller and smaller scales and burn it in the millimeter, actually sub-millimeter size viscous friction. So if you see the atmosphere and any cloud, real dissipation happens on the scale, which is usually a fraction of millimeter. So it's very, very tiny vortices are really viscous and they dissipate energy. All the rest is the energy cascade from big vortices to small and smaller one. On the other hand, two-dimensional motion, planar, they have inverse cascade of energy, and now I'll explain where it comes from. This is a three-dimensional turbulence. You see that it's a grid turbulence, so you excite motion of this scale, and then when you look inside, you see small scales. And this is a two-dimensional, this is our experiment. I'll later tell a bit more detail. So this is an initial state. We run a current through electrolyte and put small magnets below it. So we excite small vortices. This is small vortices which are excited. After a while, you see big vortices appear out of it, and eventually one big coherent vortex. So this is an example of an inverse cascade, which is happen in a two-dimensional or quasi-two-dimensional flows. And it's related to the fact that there is an extra integral of motion, actually the whole infinity, but we care for the moment only of quadratic. So when we ask what turbulence does, turbulence dissipates. So you steer it and it won't dissipate. But the point is that ideal fluid in 2D conserves not only energy, and I assume that fluid is incompressible, the density is equal to unity, all my energy is just V squared over 2. It also conserves a squared vorticity. It's a curl of velocity squared. So this is an extra invariant. Actually, it conserves all powers of vorticity, but for the sake of this argument, I need only. And now, if I imagine the situation that I excite some motion in wave number space at some wave number k1, and I assume that there is some dissipation at k2, at very small wave number, and there is some dissipation of k3, then I have two equations to satisfy. First of all energy that I input in at point 1 must be dissipated at point 2 and 3, but also all vorticity, which is basically k squared v. It's a very rough estimate. One can do mathematics and theorem out of it. And so I need to solve this two-linear equation and obtain v2 and v3. Expressed in terms of V1. Now what I see is that if my K1 is my K2 is much, much smaller than K1 here, is smaller than, then K2 is of course much smaller than K3, right? And so what I get as a result, that this V3 will be much, much smaller than V1. On the other hand, V2 would be comparable with V1. It means that the energy will be all absorbed here. On the other hand, vorticity, namely K3 squared, V3 squared, will be approximately equal to K1 squared, V1 squared. So in a sense, it tells us that the integral of motion, which has more gradients, more power of K, goes to large K. And the integral of motion, which has less, which is energy, goes to low K. So in two dimensions, all energy, if there is space, would go towards larger and larger scales, and that what creates all this beautiful Jupiter red spot and many other coherent vortices. Actually, Anzager was first who noticed this fact that two-dimensional flow tend to create big vortices. And a little bit later, we'll return to it, how strange and non-trivial the fact that out of turbulence appears something large and coherent. But for the moment, it makes for our puzzle. So we have three-dimensional turbulence on scale 3 kilometers, and it does not want to give energy to larger scale. It want to burn energy at small viscous scale. And we have 10,000, 5,000 kilometers big vortices, but they don't want to give energy to smaller scales. Two-dimensional turbulence does not do this. So that's basically the setting of this problem. And of course, there is no consistent theory, but there are some interesting, mostly experimental data, which I'll show you, and on the way we'll go. So again, this is a reiteration, how different are direct cascade and inverse cascade. And now a little bit about scaling. So where this 5/3 scaling comes out, it's a very simple statement that what turbulence does, it does a cascade. So you input energy at some scales, and it need to transfer it to some other scale where it dissipated. It could be to smaller scales in 3D, or it could be to larger scales in 2D, but the mechanism of cascade is very simple, and estimate is very easy to get. You say that if I take scale R, namely, I take 2 points of the distance R and measure velocity difference between these 2 points. It's a fluctuating quantity. I can take it squared and calculate average. So this would be a measure of a typical energy which is contained in the vortices of this scale. And if I now divide it by a typical time, which is just R divided by delta V, just a typical time which takes this vortex to make a turn over, that would give me a typical rate of energy transfer through a given scale. And if I want it to be cascade, I want this rate of transfer to be independent on the scale R. Okay? And so I require it to be just a rate with which I input energy at the source or dissipate energy at the sink. This is, by the way, as I already discussed, it's the first example of anomaly, which Dan Kolmogorov 1941 before any other quantum or other anomalies. So here, I have dissipation, let's say by viscosity. But the rate of dissipation is independent on viscosity. It's only because it's a cascade rate. As my viscosity goes to zero, the length of my cascade in wave number space increases, but the amount of energy you dissipate stays finite, which means that here the symmetry broken, time reversibility, broken by some factor viscosity, has a finite limit when this factor goes to zero. And it really could be cast in a term in terms of anomaly. It's Polyakov who first to noticed it. Well, so now if I really require this statement, that this that means that delta V cube must scale linearly with R, or delta V in the second power must scale as R in the power 2/3. If you Fourier transform it into K space, you would get K minus 5/3. The point is that this argument about spectrum, which is second moment, does not tell you which direction of the cascade. But the third moment tells you which direction of the cascade. It's for three-dimensional, this epsilon will be positive, it goes forward, and for two-dimensional, it will be negative. And we return to this point when we'll try to measure what is the third moment of velocity difference. This, by the way, also a measure of irreversibility, right? If you have a non-zero third moment of velocity, and velocity changes sign upon time reversal, the existence of a third moment is a measure of irreversibility, and it's independent on viscosity, which actually breaks time reversibility. Okay, so just let's forget, let's remember the scaling, and let's remember that the sign would tell us the direction of the cascade. So again, this atmospheric data give us 5/3, but we don't know which is 5/3. Which way energy goes, this is this direction. For this, you need not a second moment, which is spectrum, but a third moment. And then people went and tried to get third moment from this very, very, not very good data, and was very anisotropic. Chicago, Honolulu is just one line on which this plane was flying back and forth and measuring over there. And they get this third moment, and it was like because we would expect this 5-third to be, it is scales which are hundreds of kilometers. Those vortices are planar. There is nothing three-dimensional about it. So we would expect it to be inverse cascade. But we get sine, which would be like in like a direct cascade. And this was the data of measurement, and that was for a while, just nobody understood what's going on here. And so at some point, started to do laboratory experiment, trying to make a very, very simple modeling of this very, very complicated phenomena. And so a few words I'll tell you. That's, as I say, you have magnets below, you drive current, this current you drive through it. And as you drive current, by Lorentz force, you excite small vortices. And then you look at the spectra, you see initially they appear on this scale of a forcing. And after a while, you see this inverse cascade built out with a scaling 5-third. You multiply energy by 5-third, you have the constant. So you really can, in the lab, demonstrate that by small scale steering, you create a larger and larger and larger vortices, and their scaling is 5-third. I want you to feel how strange it is. So you expect that turbulence is breaking things, mixing things, right? Destroying information, right? It's a very non-equilibrium state. You expect it to be. Now, what it does instead in two dimensions, it self-organizes into more and more coherent objects. And then there is another strange thing, which now I'll mention briefly, which could be interesting for you as a theoretical physicist. This is, of course, not a laboratory experiment. It's a numerics. This is a forcing scale. So it's a huge, on the Earth, we cannot have that large scale separation between forcing scale and the Bosch size. Here it's three decades. And what is colored here is the regions of different sign of vorticity. For two-dimensional flow, vorticity is either up or down. It's pseudo-scalar, right? So positive, and what is colored here are only positive vorticity. Black is negative. Actually, it is as much color as black, just your eye fool you. And you see how fractal it is. This 5-third scaling comes out of this correlation of this fractal field. But there is something much more interesting to it. If we look at the boundaries between positive vorticity, which on the Earth we would call cyclone, and negative vorticity, which we would call anticyclone on the Earth, because it's a sign related to a planet rotation. If we have vortex rotating the same direction which the planet rotates, we'll call it a cyclone. So now, if we look at this line, this is just a magnification of a line of zero vorticity, which separates these two regions. You see how fractal it is. We can, and it's also not a simple line. It has double points. And we can make an external perimeter, a hull, it's called in mathematics, out of it. And then we can look at its fractal dimension. This is the perimeter of the line, not the name of the institute. We see that it scales for the line itself with a scaling approximately 7/4, and for its external perimeter with a scaling 4/3. And those are very magic numbers, and if somebody studied percolation, it would immediately recognize these magic numbers. But now I'll comment for the rest. And the double points itself are clustering. They are actually not points. They are also some fat fractal. It is related to the very beautiful piece of mathematics, which was already recognized by several Fields Medal, and it's called Schramm-Lowney revolution, and it's very intimately related with conformal field theory. This all goes back to the old idea by Lowney, which tells you how you can encode a curve on a plane into the motion of a point on a straight line. So the idea of Lowney was as follows. Imagine that you have half space, and here is a curve, gamma, which goes into it. Let's say it goes until this point. You can consider this as a slit. Namely, that what you actually have, you have a half plane minus this curve. As a domain, you can always map it into a half plane, which means that the image of this tip would be somewhere on a surface, on a boundary, because it's a boundary, so its image must be on a boundary, and it's now half plane. Now, as your curve propagates, then this point will move. So in a sense, the law by which this point moves as a function of time, and here time is just coordinate along this curve, encodes completely the position of this curve in plane. And then Loewner derived a beautiful Loewner equation which describes this map from here to here and how it relates to it. 8 years later, Israeli mathematician Shram, also from Weizmann Institute at that time, we were assistant professors together at the same time, and he unfortunately died in the mountain accident. So Adet Shram, and this is the first part of it, understood the following things. If this point makes a Brownian walk, then this curve is a random curve. Then it has conformally invariant statistics. And then if you properly make everything dimensionless, namely that this map goes to unity at infinity, it's, then this diffusivity with which you move this point, it's the only number, it's dimensionless number which characterizes this curve or class of curves. And then everything that we knew about integrable models of two-dimensional statistical physics fell into different classes of different kappas. For example, Ising domain walls are kappa equal to 3. Percolation are kappa equal to 6. And all the self-avoiding walk in other kappa, etc. So in a sense, this was a way, at least for me, as not a field theorist, as a fluid mechanicist, last, I understand why conformal invariant appears, because conformal invariance is a local scale invariance. And Brownian walk is ultimately local. It forgets itself at every step, right? So of course, you can take a Brownian walk, which is kind of has no memory, and map it into something which has a non-trivial power law correlation. But it's still ultimately local. You did not impose any true non-locality. And so it's happened to be very powerful language by which people from mathematics, random walks, and integrable models start to talk to each other. So it's I included this piece just for the sake that if you have a curve, a random curve, just download a standard checking algorithm, which is basically making this map, and check if it belongs to this class. Because if it belongs, you had a formalism of conformal field theory just working for you. And of course, in turbulence, we were ecstatic when we, this is something which we established purely empirically. And there is no theory which explains why the hell the motion of two-dimensional fluid in the regime of inverse cascade follows this rule. But here it is. Here is this psi of t, which is built out of experimental data, out actually of this set. We took this set, all these lines. For every line, we found this function zeta of t. Then we found its statistics. And then we shown that if you take this zeta squared divided by t, you expect it to get kappa. And our kappa happened to be 6, and it's something which corresponds to percolation. So in this sense, there is something really strange, that the zero vorticity lines, this, by the way, where weather changes from cyclone to anticyclone, right, are statistically equivalent to just maybe simplest class of critical phenomena, namely the undirected percolation. And there is no explanation for it, and there are a lot of, I mean, I spent 3 years trying to get any theory, and many mathematicians work about it, and I really don't want to go into much detail here, but just to let you know that a motion of two-dimensional fluid is really something miraculous. But it's not only, so there are many different systems, for which lines, first of all, is critical phenomena. So everything you know, like Potts model or any type of two-dimensional local critical model with local Hamiltonians necessarily belong to this class, produce lines. There is random walks. There is our inverse cascades. There is also a very interesting class of phenomena that you have a wave functions in a really in billiard-like system or whatever, where a wave function have a random-like level sets. And those level sets also very often belong to this class. And then Matthew Hessings found that some spin glasses also have a domain walls belonging to this class. And eventually, the ultimate fractal, you know, the idea of a fractal appeared because of studying a coastline of Britain. And then when we now return back to all this data, and we not only ask about what is the fractal dimension of this coastline, but whether this whole set of moments related to it could be organized into conformal field theory, then it happens that coastlines divide into two classes, and one is like rocky coastlines, where there is really rock. And another is like sandy, like more plain. And rocky coastlines belong to this class, and again, nobody knows why. So this is just a digression about the totally unexpected properties of this inverse cascade in 2D. Now let's return back to this inverse cascade and ask what will happen ultimately with it. Because as I've said, out of small vortices appear larger vortices. And if system is finite, appears one large big flow which fills the whole domain. Of course, there is turbulence inside it too, but you just don't see it because it's so strong. And we study this creation of this vortex. First of all, we know that we input energy at small scales. Our input of energy are magnets and Lorentz force. And there's really only input in this laboratory experiment of energy at small scales. And we can really check that everything we input through these scales flows through the inverse cascade and eventually dissipated by this vortex just because of bottom friction. We make this friction very, very small by using lubricant, another layer of a fluid, which is dielectric. So we drive electrolyte, but below it is a layer of a very thin layer, which actually make a friction very, very small. And then again, we look at our data. Now it's a laboratory. You can measure everything you really want to measure. It's not like you measure it for one line like this atmospheric data. And now we can, from our measurement, subtract this big vortex and get only turbulent data. And for this turbulent data, we look at the third moment and find out that it's positive, as it must be in the inverse cascade. So it's really inverse cascade. Its slope is precisely the same rate with which energy decays when we switch on forcing. So everything fits together. We really have it all set. And there is also another interesting piece of it that we can look inside this big vortex and build a theory of its profile, because it's a vortex which is fed by turbulence. There is turbulence inside, and this turbulence always works like this, that the vortices of the same size. How you create turbulence? You run current, and you have magnets which make such vortices, and you make anticyclone and you may cyclone. But your big vortex which appears has one direction of rotation. It's like your Earth's rotation in this case. And so you see what actually the way how this system supports it all the time. That anticyclone getting thrown away into the periphery because there are four counter-rotating vortices in the corner of our system. If you look over here and over here and over here, you see counter-rotating vortices. Anticyclone goes there and supports them. And cyclones get sucked into this vortex and add to it the rotation. So this is a mechanism for which the system supports it. And probably I won't go into much details. One can build a theory of this profile, then do numerics and check. There is a square root of 3, which is analytically calculated, not very often happens in turbulence theory. And there is the data which more or less shows that this vortex has this predicted profile, etc. But it was all done with practically two-dimensional system, very, very, very thin. Namely, that all the input would be into only two-dimensional vortices. But remember that atmosphere is different. It has this three-dimensional convection on a scale of 10 kilometers. And it also has these big vortices. So now we want to make it these experiments with the more thick layers of a fluid. And I'm a theoretician, by the way. So mostly my role here was asking for several years experimentalists to add a little bit more water. It's very difficult, actually, to make this layer more thick. But before that, people did it numerically. So what you do numerically, and that was done by these people, they just numerically modeled three-dimensional system with a big aspect ratio. And the forcing scale now could be made comparable with the depths. And so we're interested to know whether as you increase the depths relatively to the force scale, the system at some point goes from two-dimensional to three-dimensional. So in a sense, they wanted to see this dimensional transition from exciting first very, very plain vortices to exciting something more and more three-dimensional. And they indeed found that as the ratio of a vertical scale to the forcing scales was 1/8, it is this line. The energy was still growing, namely that this energy cascade went to larger and larger and larger scales. But as you hit 1/2, namely that this was 1/2 of that, it's already three-dimensional. Energy saturated, namely that everything that you input into system burned at small scales by viscosity. Nothing goes to large big vortices, so energy does not accumulate. And the conclusion was that in the atmosphere, it's impossible to produce out of three-dimensional convective turbulence the big planar vortices, because the moment it's 1/2, and in the atmosphere it's typically even less because it's more three-dimensional than this, you would not get any energy towards large scale. Everything will be burnt in the direct cascade. This run was 2 months on a supercomputer. It was really almost 3 months. It's really very heavy computations. And then we started to do experiment with precisely this type of system. And this is now much better. This is built in Australia by Michael Schatz's lab. Now we have 900 magnets, 30 by 30. It's a really vast array of magnets. So we can excite 900 vortices and see how they produce this turbulence, and then eventually one big vortex. And this is what we see. So more or less, this 3 months of supercomputer corresponds to 5 seconds of running experiments. Nature is very good computing device, right? It solves Navier-Stokes equation very, very fast. That's we see what more or less people see in numerics, that it's totally three-dimensional. This is a view from a side on our box, and this view from above, right? So we see that it's practically three-dimensional, and there are no big vortices over here. But we can run a little bit more seconds here, right? So we run it for another 15 seconds, and that's what appeared. The big vortex appeared out of this mess. And when you look from a side, you see not a two-dimensional flow. It actually has a profile here, but it's planar. Namely, the streamlines almost like this. So in a sense, what was observed here is the following fact, that as you have this turbulence, it's practically three-dimensional, but there is a small leakage, which it's a random system. So it sometimes creates a big planar vortex, a little bit larger than the scale. The moment you create it, it's already almost two-dimensional, and it wanna create even larger vortex. But when you have a big vortex, which is almost two-dimensional, what it does to small three-dimensional vortices, it kills them. So if you have this big planar flow, it has this shear, vertical shear. And if you have this vortex, it just shears this vortex, it kills it. So eventually, this big two-dimensional vortex so hungry, so it organizes its own food supply by killing three-dimensional vortices of this side and turning this, your three-dimensional turbulence into almost, it's not two-dimensional, of course, it's much more complicated, but it's basically planar. So it is this mechanism which from here to get, you really need a spontaneous appearance of some larger vortices here. It immediately make it almost two-dimensional locally, which immediately gives it even more energy because it's now inverse cascade, and so it goes. Yes?
So are the vortices just at the very top, or do they go down to the whole thickness?
What we excite is practically three-dimensional vortices like this. They have as much this component as much that component.
The final one, the bigger one.
A final vortex is a box size two-dimensional like this.
But it's thick. It's this thing.
Oh, the system has aspect ratio huge. I mean, we have something like 40 centimeters and like 5-7 millimeters. But the forcing scale is comparable to the depth. That's what your atmosphere has a huge aspect ratio, right? But the point is that the forcing scale now comparable with the depth. So we really excite three-dimensional turbulence. But for the fact that you have a huge horizontal extent, spontaneously big planar vortices appear. And these planar vortices locally organize everything as if you produce two-dimensional vortices. And so it seems that this is a mechanism by which the system is self-organizes itself so that it can suck this part of the energy, at least, of three-dimensional convective turbulence into this larger scale vortices. And of course, it's a very, very simple system. It's a laboratory system really devised to study this phenomenon, but it could be that it really catches something out of it. And of course, we can do it, not wait for the big vortex to appear, but because it's electrolyte, we can take a big magnet, bring it over there, and it excites a big vortex. And that's what we did in this experiment. So at some point, we just, at this point, we put a big magnet. So initially we had, during this time, we had usual turbulence excited by small scales. Then we brought a big magnet and it created this flow, which was practically planar. It's, again, we look from a side, it's a big vortex, the size of our magnet, which was 20 centimeters, I guess. This, and then when we took this magnet away, namely after, and this is already 9 seconds, it's it's over here. Then we see how this three-dimensionality start to reappear starting from the bottom. So the system really wants to be three-dimensional, and it's only existence of the big vortex which make it locally like two-dimensional, but that what how this vortex really guarantees its own energy supply. And then, of course, you can study the spectra, and it looks remarkably similar to what is in the atmosphere, and nobody reads too much into the similarity, because again, atmosphere is very, very complicated. But then you recognize that the fact that the spectrum has this knee, this part which was k minus 3 here, in our case, is just part of a vortex. Vortex creates its own contribution into energy spectrum. And of course, it decays much faster than k minus 5 third because it's practically large scale coherent field and it's approximately k to minus 3 here. But the point is that it really has a knee. You can subtract it. You can look at the third moment. Third moment is really, it's third moment is a flux of energy. Remember, it's what determines the flux, and the flux is what it should be. So this more or less data which could really tell that even though it looks very unbelievable in the first sense, that something which is totally three-dimensional can produce very large planar vortices as long as you have a layer of a fluid, it still could work. And this is a moral which we can get out of this laboratory experiment and then try to apply it to a real world. And then David Byrne, who was a graduate student who did, of course, as all you know that science is done by graduate students, really. So this is a guy who did most of the experimental data. After graduation, he went to work for Meteorological Agency and came across the data of two big hurricanes. And this data actually were produced by unbelievably brave people who flew several times a small plane in and out of a hurricane. And that's a flight path. I guess there was Ferdinand and Isabella, and that was probably Ferdinand. It was a huge hurricane. It cost North Carolina part of its territory, by the way, just wash it away. And they did it several times at several heights. And as they were flying there, they collected the data on wind velocity. The same way as these people who flew from Chicago to Guadalupe, but now on a much smaller scale, but of course, it's a much more dangerous mission. And this data was sitting there for several years, nobody using it. And then David came to this data, and because it was really very detailed data measurement, and tried to get out of them what? The third moment. The third moment of velocity difference tells you which way energy flows. If the third moment, namely V1 minus V2 projected on this line, cube, if it's positive, it's an inverse cascade. If it's negative, it's a direct cascade. Yeah, is this, and that's what he found, that depending on which height, you remember, they were flying at different heights. So depending on which height you were actually flying, that you, at low heights, this is this data. You clearly, this is a third moment as a function of a distance. If it's Kolmogorov type turbulence, it's supposed to be linear function of the distance. It is linear function of the distance. The slope, if it's positive, it's an inverse cascade. If it's negative, it's a direct cascade. So you see that very close to the ocean floor, it's a really three-dimensional turbulence, and it has a direct cascade. And as you pass approximately 150 meters, it is two sets of data, there you see that it's really getting more planar-wise, and it's a pretty decent scaling, to tell you the truth. It's not from laboratory, it's from a real hurricane, right? And it shows that at least, whatever strange it may sound, of course, the main source of hurricane energy, it's not related to small-scale turbulence. It's there is a condensation there and vapor and a lot of things. But it's absolutely clear that at higher level, the part of a macroscopic motion of the hurricane gets its energy out of small-scale turbulence, not giving it to small-scale turbulence as it does below. And this is Isabel, and this is a Fabian. This is another. And then here, they even caught at this height, more or less a neutral layer, where this transition from a three-dimensional type turbulence into two-dimensional planar type turbulence really appear. And which does not mean that on a global scale, necessarily something like this happened. And really, if you go and talk to atmospheric people and meteorologists say, well, we know there is this physicist who claims that there could be an inverse cascade, that the really convective turbulence can produce. Well, we'll know in 50 years, which is true. I mean, it's a very complicated system. There are many things going on. But at least this is part of nature. At least it happens here and there. And again, I want to reiterate how strange it is. I mean, this inverse cascade, in my opinion, may be the most strange and interesting things which appeared out of fluid mechanics in last, I don't know, 50 years after Kolmogorov. It's basically Bob Kreiknen invented it. Was the last assistant of Einstein, Bob Kreiknen. With Bruce DeWitt, they were two last assistants of Einstein at Princeton. This idea is very strange. It's a way of self-organization coming out of turbulence. It has this, on the way, as this inverse cascade proceeds, you see that it had these strange traces of conformal invariance. Of course, turbulence is much more than conformal field theory, because the main thing about turbulence is about time. It's about irreversibility. It's about breaking detailed balance. And this is something about a snapshot of zero vorticity lines, which is only kind of one sector of turbulence statistics. Still, it is interesting and strange that in this inverse cascade, we now have a whole family of such inverse cascades, they, in some sense, has conformal field theory hidden behind them. After this inverse cascade reaches the box scale, it creates this big vortex, and this big vortex that can rearrange the motion even inside the relatively deep layer so that it would be this inverse cascade. And this is just the last thing which I'm doing, is that I believe that fluid mechanics is worth knowing. And this is a book, and I brought it as a present for your library. You don't have a very long shelf of fluid mechanics books. This is the shortest book on fluid mechanics. It's really a very thin book. I wrote it because it was written for people like you, for physicists who are very busy. All physicists are very busy. You don't have much time. You cannot read Landau-Lifshitz, which is an excellent book, by the way. But it is any decent book on fluid mechanics, it is that big. Because fluid mechanics is always in between physics, engineering, and mathematics. And this is written for physicists. And I think that in fluids, there are many, many things which people from condensed matter to quantum field theory can find some things to work on, how to get inspiration out of it. So let me finish this point.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the book.
Two short questions. One, so the Coriolis force has nothing to do with the formation. The Coriolis force has nothing to do with the formation of big vortices.
Coriolis force does no work, right? It's always perpendicular to the velocity, so it does no work. Of course, it's important in a way that it organizes large-scale structure of atmospheric flows. And I did not talk about coherent part of atmospheric flow. I talk only about random part, which are spectra and fluctuation. And it's a very non-trivial five-jet structure. And of course, it's different heights. Coriolis force play a crucial role in organizing this large-scale flow. But from the viewpoint of a small-scale turbulence on a scale of 10 kilometers, it does not matter what structure of a global flow. It matters that locally it's just a shear which tries to kill three-dimensional vortices. So in this sense, there is a lot of details which are hidden and not given here. It's about most basic aspect of energy exchange. But of course, Coriolis force is very important in determining the whole structure of Earth's circulation. It's very non-trivial.
So the other question is related. You said that in planar flows, the system organizes itself into a big vortex and four small vortices at the periphery. What if you do that on a sphere?
Excellent question. That's what we are working right now. So in a sphere, there's no boundaries, right? So imagine that you on a sphere, you put a small scale forcing, and it would create this turbulence, and it must create something big. What it is? Analytically, I immediately get a solution, and the solution is just two jet. In one, total momentum is conserved, so it must be in one hemisphere, this one. Well, then you say, okay, but our planet is actually rotating, so you start rotating. It's still a solution, but now it's an unstable solution. It starts to break into multi-jet structures. This is where Coriolis force comes into, because when you rotate, you now have a preferable direction and then another. And if you consider it's two-dimensional on a sphere, it's a solvable problem, which we are now in the process of solving. There was a lot of numerics for many, many years, but not much of analytic theory. It's done only now. But the problem with the real Earth is that, of course, it's not two-dimensional. It has a finite depth, and this finite depth is very important. And when you look at the global circulation of atmosphere, it's different at different heights. So it's planar, but its vertical profile is very non-trivial, and it changes direction in some places. So it could be near the surface this way and up at the troposphere that way. And there are hardly cells which are kind of this vertical circulation pattern. So it's pretty complicated, but it's doable. I mean, in 20 years, we'll sort it out, I'm sure. And computers are getting better. And of course, I dream about having a small rotating sphere in the lab.
The third order structure function is extremely hard to measure numerically. I was always puzzled as to why they're so successful in experiments in measuring it, especially given that it's much more difficult to measure the velocity field in an experiment.
That's true, but no. For example, in the Chladni-Buffetta data, they have very beautiful sort of order structures for 2D. In 3D, numerically, it's very difficult because in 3D, we aren't even close to having a decent scale separation and decent inertial interval. But in 2D, numerics pretty good in getting third moment. And normally, in 2D, numerics are better than experiment. Normally, in 3D, experiments are better than numerics. That's the rule of thumb. But of course, this data, particularly Schatz data, I mean, he is one of the greatest experimentalists. Really, it's a very expensive optical system of measuring velocity. It's really very good data.
Any other questions?
Yeah,
did I understand you right that in the, when you went from the, when you had the thickness and you got this spontaneous big vortex, that was just a fluctuation that started the big vortex?
In a sense, yes. And it's initially you don't get this big vortex which is system size. You have just large vortices here and there which are larger than the thickness. They start locally reorganize your three-dimensional turbulence into almost planar. The moment it's almost planar, then it produces inverse cascade. What is basically inverse cascade? Two middle-sized vortices make one big vortex out of them. Right? So you have two vortices, right? And they come to each other and they create one big vortex like an envelope. But you need for this them to be two-dimensional, not to having this one.
So what eventually happens, you create two vortices which locally organize it as if they are planar, but the moment they are almost planar, they tend to produce larger vortices. But escape out of spontaneous fluctuation on a scale larger than thickness.
So what sets the time scale for that to happen?
Good question. I don't know. The truth is, I don't know. Because in a sense, it takes time. You see, for certain time, it's just three-dimensional turbulence. So in a sense, it's like something like a rare fluctuation. One can probably get some kind of instanton formalism to get a maximum of probability for this very rare fluctuation, but nobody did it. So my guess is that you have this like three-dimensional turbulence, but with a large aspect ratio. Spontaneously, rare fluctuation appear, and then it takes system to induce it. No theory. Yes, ma'am.
So you showed this minus 5/3 exponent, so that's for second moment of velocity flow, and then third moment is that the sign is determined by essentially dimensionality. And
it's the sign determined by the direction of cascade, which depends on dimensionality. In 2D it's an inverse cascade, and sign is positive, and 3D it's a direct cascade, and sign is negative. So you can say that it's determined by dimensionality.
But do we know okay, all moments? Is that a solved
no.
problem? And
we don't know all moments, and it's a different story. It's all this 90s when Eric C.J., Boris Schreiman, and Christoph, and me, that we did it for much simpler problem of passive scalar. If you're interested in higher moments, they all have very non-trivial scalings, exponent, which are totally unrelated to this 5/3 or whatever, which are related to some zero modes which exist in this problem, to some statistical integrals of motion, but that needs a separate problem. Because it's not scale invariant system. It has an infinite number of dimensionalities. Yes?
I was wondering whether the formation of a big vortex could be due to some kind of stochastic resonance effect. If the system has some intrinsic mode of a certain size and frequency, you can excite it by white noise because it's also in the spectrum.
In a sense, you have a box size.
Yes.
Which sets, but it does not set you the frequency. Frequency or period is this size divided by velocity. But typical velocity which you reach is determined by your friction factor, because this friction factor times this velocity squared will give you a rate of energy dissipation which is set by small magnet. So you are right, but it's kind of a little bit more complicated. Your rate of energy input determines the velocity of a big guy, because a scale fixed, it gives you a period, and it is on this period which is actually resonance and it starts to pump. But again, it's all hand-waving argument, not that anybody did any theory about it. Yes?
So it's been observed that in three-dimensional turbulence, you can have an inverse cascade if you have a breaking of helicity, if you have a helicity bias.
It's still controversial. There are some traces. For example, you can impose locally rotation on three-dimensional fluid, and you would locally get its like inverse cascade because it would be effectively two-dimensional. To what extent helicity is a product of velocity and vorticity, the scalar product, right? It tells you whether your lines like this. It could be. But it's not proved, and it's not established, and we don't understand the condition for it, whether it could be inverse cascade in 3D.
Okay, I was going to ask whether there could be a mechanism on the Earth to create a helicity bias at the small scales.
I don't know. Helicity is not sign definite, in a sense that you always create helicity, but as much positive as much negative. What is good about energy, kinetic energy, is always positive. Squared vorticity is always positive. You create it, you need to burn it, right? With helicity, you can create it, could disappear, because it's not sign different. So it's, you cannot talk about cascade of helicity, whether you create it at small scales, and then it would go somewhere. It could be that it still could be a cascade of helicity in some sense, but not in this trivial sense like you can have a cascade of sign definite integral of motion. But the moment you created energy, it's positive, you need to burn it. And helicity is different.
Okay, so maybe let's thank Gregory, and we'll have some snacks in the next room.
Okay.